So this post is a continuation from my last post called Reasoning from Utopia versus Reality, where I discuss the channel's second thought, which describes itself as being devoted to the education and analysis of current events from a leftist perspective. The channel has dedicated many videos to denouncing capitalism and promoting socialism. Surprisingly, one source found 2/3 of young Britons want to live under a socialist economic system, and data from 2023 showed that 54% of Gen Z hold negative views of capitalism, and 41% hold favorable views of socialism. To be clear, Second Thought isn't talking about something like socialism, as in capitalism with strong welfare policies, but actual socialism, as in government seizing the means of production. For example, in his video titled "Why Would Anyone Work Under Socialism?", he describes the capitalist workplace as being bad because you have to do what your boss tells you to, and that, quote, as a result of the common ownership of the means of production, this kind of thing would not be a feature of socialism, end quote. He's also said in his America's Looming Housing Crisis video that if you have wealth at your disposal, you should, quote, buy and distribute copies of socialist books, because after all, quote, we wouldn't have had Marx without Engels. If Second Thought was not advocating for collective ownership over the means of production, but something more like a free market capitalist economy with more welfare providing more security for the citizens, I probably wouldn't be writing this. By the way, many people have said that we should be socialist like Denmark, but Denmark isn't socialist. The Denmark Prime Minister himself said specifically, quote, I know that some people in the US associate the Nordic model with some sort of socialism. Therefore, I would like to make one thing clear. Denmark is far from a socialist planned economy. Denmark is a market economy. As part two to my Reasoning from Utopia versus Reality post, in this article we'll investigate one type of thinking used in Second Thought's video, what Thomas Sowell calls one-stage thinking. As described in this excerpt from his book, when Sowell was studying economics under Professor Arthur Smithies at Harvard, he asked Sowell what policy he favored on a particular issue of the times. Sowell explained to Smithies the beneficial outcomes he could expect from his favorite policy. Smithies then asked him, and then what will happen? Sowell then stopped for a moment to think and went on to explain the economic consequences he could expect from his policy. Smithies then asked him again, and then what will happen? Sowell started to speculate more, and he came to realize some of the negatives that his preferred policy would lead up to. Smithies persisted, asking him again, and then what will happen? Sowell finally realized that after enough dominoes had fallen, the policy he advocated for would eventually make people worse off than before it was enacted. So in this article, to get a grasp of the perils of and the cure for one-stage thinking, first, we'll take a look at Second Thought's video titled, Why Would Anyone Work Under Socialism? Second, we'll pick up where we left off last time and take a look at one of the solutions he proposed in his video, How Capitalism Causes Loneliness. And third, we'll do a deep dive into the utopia-first approach to the homeless crisis in California because it's similar to Second Thought's solution to the housing issue, the socialist utopia where humans stop behaving like humans. Second Thought has made a different video titled Why Would Anyone Work Under Socialism? He says that having to work to earn food or housing is a brutal way of organizing labor in a society. After describing how in a socialist society, the government would take care of people's food, shelter, and so on, he asks, how do you get people to work if all their basic needs are met? Then he essentially argues that people will still be motivated to work because it will be a lot more fun, because you won't have a boss and the workers will just collectively call the shots. First off, I'm wondering how exactly this works when people drastically differ in areas of expertise, experience, and competence. There's a reason factories in the States require factory managers to have 5+ years experience in engineering and operations management, and they pay these people a lot, about 6 figures. What would be the alternative? Just having unskilled workers just come to an agreement on how the factory should run? In any case, there are of course tons of terrible employers in the States making people's jobs super crappy. But is whoever has the last say on which line cook will do what at the socialist government-approved Burger King going to be any less of a jerk than an actual boss in a capitalist restaurant? In any case, Second Thought argues that once people move out of capitalist workplaces that treat you like a, quote, interchangeable cog, and into socialist workplaces that, quote, take up a lot less of your time and treat you like a human being with agency, we will then be encouraged to work because we will just enjoy it, like we enjoy cooking a meal for ourselves. though apparently we won't be encouraged to work as much as in capitalism because, as he says, work will take up a lot less of our time. Second Thought says, quote, if we can make the unpleasant things we do pleasant, we will do them because that's how we treat everything else. That's why we cook for ourselves, make our beds, and clean the counters. It's why 1/4 of Americans volunteer. We make necessary things pleasant. Doing work with a clear result that has a demonstrable impact where you can see progress and where you work with other people makes people happy. Work that takes this into account, not just the bottom line, is work that is attractive. We can do that for the whole economy once we stop prioritizing profits, end quote. Okay, so somehow janitors, traffic wardens, portable toilet cleaners, bricklayers, roadkill collectors, sewer cleaners, crime scene cleaners, pest control officers, dead fish harvesters, and so on will all be motivated to do their usually unpleasant jobs despite already having food, housing, and other basic needs already met. And they won't be resentful of the people doing the much cushier jobs. Are wind turbine technicians still going to be motivated to risk their lives to do their duty despite not really having to? Who's going to volunteer to do the jobs listed as the most dangerous by OSHA? Jobs like roofers, logging workers, construction workers, fishing and hunting workers, structural iron and steel workers, underground mining machine operators, and refuse waste and recyclable material collectors. Are people going to enjoy those jobs just because they can see the impact that their work is making? So I bring that up because I want you to keep this logic in mind as we go forward, because these flawed assumptions about human behavior are pretty illustrative of why Second Thought's video on loneliness doesn't pan out. At 10:51 in the video we discussed last time, how capitalism causes loneliness, Second Thought suggests that one of the solutions to capitalism-caused loneliness is to guarantee housing to alleviate people's mental stressors, and we could do this by redistributing vacant houses. Second Thought says, quote, how many sources of anxiety, stress, suicidality, depression, anger, and misery do you think could be avoided if we used all the empty houses at our disposal to guarantee people a home instead of sitting on them until they turn to profit, end quote. This sounds really nice, but as Thomas Sowell has said, there are no solutions, only trade-offs. The problem with the whatever sounds the kindest is the best course of action because it is most fair and moral approach is that it crumbles under questions about the specifics, and questions like, and then what will happen? How socialism will solve loneliness? Guaranteed housing? To address what Second Thought said and this topic of income inequality and its connection to the housing crisis means addressing first, whether giving out vacant houses would solve the homeless situation. Second, whether guaranteeing housing will solve the mental stress non-homeless people bear in trying to afford their housing. And third, the root problem of housing. For now, we'll get into the weeds of this first point, because the best way to combat simplistic ideas like socialism or just give people those empty houses that sound really nice is to get into the specifics. While they sound really fair and moral at first glance, they don't really make any sense when you start asking questions. So, can't we just Robin Hood all those empty houses? I'm not here to necessarily argue what the perfect solution is to the homeless crisis, but I'm going to offer reasons why a Second Thought's proposed solution to give the homes of the exploiters to the exploited is far too simplistic, and why b the problem isn't necessarily capitalism itself. So, in 2022, 582,462 people were homeless in the United States. Newsweek puts the number of empty homes in the United States at 16 million. So even when you account for the fact that about a third of these vacant homes are run down and or prohibitively expensive to make habitable and to upkeep, and that another third of these are just simply temporarily vacant while switching between renters, and that another chunk of these vacant houses are not in areas that are practical for the homeless to live in, theoretically, there should be enough vacant houses left over that you could steal 582,462 of them from their owners and give them to people in need. So this approach of Robin Hooding these vacant houses sounds a lot like the Housing First approach to solving homelessness. The proponents of Housing First describe it as a homeless assistance approach that prioritizes providing permanent housing to people experiencing homelessness, thus ending their homelessness and serving as a platform from which they can pursue personal goals and improve their quality of life. But does this solve the root issues of homelessness? Progressive strategies rewarding dependency. Loving to death. Consider this viral tweet where a homeless Portland woman describes being homeless as a piece of cake. In the tweet, she says, it's a piece of cake. You get three meals a day and you don't have to do shit. You wake up, you eat, you get high. You wake up, you eat, you get high on repeat. She says, they are loving us to death. Michael Schellenberger, author of San Francisco, says that the homeless problem in California, the state with the most homeless per 10,000 people, is mischaracterized as a problem of too high rent. Rather, the root problem is drug abuse and untreated mental illness. Schellenberger says, quote, I think my fellow progressives did a disservice by suggesting that this is just about high rents. If you can't afford the rent, the last place you're going to go live is on the most dangerous and dirty streets in America. You're going to move out of state. You're going to move in with friends. Addicts looking to maintain their addiction end up going to the most liberal places, and it ends up concentrating the problem, and it also prevents us from being able to solve the problem in the cheapest way possible. Dr. Stephen Aid, author of Homelessness in America, The History and Tragedy of an Intractable Social Problem, wrote a thorough report in 2020 titled Housing First and the Homeless: The Rhetoric and the Reality. He writes in his report that Housing First has two chief tenets. One, the most effective solution to the homelessness is permanent housing. And two, all housing for the homeless should be provided immediately without any preconditions such as sobriety requirements. Michael Schellenberger elaborates on that second part, saying, I think people don't understand that the so-called Housing First policy has backfired. Housing First is this really utopian idea that you can provide an apartment for anybody who says they want one and says that they're homeless in San Francisco. The right way to do it is to provide people with shelter, basic shelter, clean and safe shelter, and then make housing a reward for good behavior, whether that's abstinence and sobriety or following through on your psychiatric care. San Franciscans have not done that. They actually sought to remove all consequences of dangerous and illegal behavior from people that they've determined to be victims. He expands on this point, commenting that this idea that not expecting anything of the homeless while giving them a free housing is an effect of the victim ideology growing in progressives. He says, a lot of it is also victim ideology, which is like they're victims of trauma and racism and poverty and whatever and addiction and mental illness. So that means you should give them things like their own apartment and offer them help, but don't require that they get this help. Don't mandate it, because that would be an extension of the victimization. And that's where everything goes wrong. Here I've added a tweet of Michael Schellenberger's where he's talked to a homeless person on the street, and the person has said, they pay people to be homeless here. Schellenberger writes, people say lack of housing forces local residents into the streets, but James says he came from Texas to San Francisco for the drugs, the non-enforcement of anti-camping laws, and the $820 a month in welfare and food stamps. Obviously, it's all about how you incentivize people's behavior. If you don't punish camping or open drug usage, and you pay people $820 a month to be homeless, you might just get an influx of drug-addicted people coming to your city with not much motivation to stop being homeless. Now, don't get me wrong that Michael Schellenberger is saying that the homeless should be left to fend for themselves without much help from the government, because any sort of help will make them dependent. Not at all. Schellenberger says that we should want that everyone has a safe and clean place to sleep. The most dangerous place to be is the streets. However, he also says this provided shelter should not be so nice that it attracts people to want to stay there. As discussed earlier, he accounts for basic human motivations, and he says housing should be something given as a reward for good behavior. He's written an article titled Three Times More Homeless Die Under Housing First Than Shelter First Policies, where he criticizes Gavin Newsom's policies that have left homeless people on the dangerous streets while waiting for the turn at very expensive free housing, while not having access to shelters because money has been diverted away from the shelters for the permanent housing. Again, we have to analyze how people are incentivized. Data from 2015 shows that covering the housing needs of the homeless for free, no strings attached, didn't encourage them to go work. It did the opposite. The 2015 Family Option Study found evidence that housing subsidies, quote, instead of granting recipients the freedom to focus more on employment and less on their housing instability challenges, it actually led to diminished work effort. In sum, housing subsidies increased rates of housing stability, but not self-sufficiency. Good intentions versus reality. One of the big arguments for the Housing First, or PSH, permanent supportive housing, is that it will act as a platform for people to improve other areas of their life. Once they have their housing settled, they can get their life together. But as suggested already, good intentions does not lead to a good reality. Dr. Judge Glock writes in his article, Housing First is a Failure, that, quote, we've built over 200,000 new PSH units for the homeless. as they're known. And since 2013, the federal government has mandated the Housing First strategy nationwide. Yet since that nationwide mandate has gone into effect, we've seen street homelessness increase by almost a fourth. California made Housing First a requirement for state-funded homeless programs in 2016. Yet, so many communities that participated in the campaign to end homelessness, such as Los Angeles and San Francisco, are now dealing with unprecedented homeless crises. Since 2010, California has added more than 25,000 permanent supportive housing units, an increase of about two-thirds. Yet, the state's unsheltered homeless population increased by half. Michael Schellenberger states that despite homelessness declining by 18% in the rest of the United States, it has increased by 31% in California. Again, part of the problem is that, quote, Gavin Newsom keeps making homelessness worse by offering free housing to drug addicts and refusing to crack down on open drug scenes. But wouldn't having the comfort of a house give homeless people enough mental leeway to work on getting clean? Stephen Ade points out that housing is not the same as treatment. Housing First's record at addressing behavioral health disorders such as untreated serious mental illness and drug addiction is far weaker than its record at promoting residential stability. Dr. Judge Glock also wrote, quote, studies have now shown that simply providing people subsidized housing does not reduce drug use, and it often encourages it, which makes sense because there is no mandated treatment in PSH, and the free unit provides people with more money to pursue their habits. In one randomized controlled trial in Ottawa, the homeless put in PSH had higher rates of substance use, mental illness, and death than people simply left on the streets. More concerning, a survey of all PSH studies from the National Academies of Science found that, quote, there is no substantial published evidence as yet to demonstrate that PSH improves health outcomes. Thus, PSH on its own is not an effective or cost-efficient tactic for improving the lives of the chronically homeless. So it's not really a hard concept to grasp that if someone lost their livelihood and apartment to addiction, and then lived with family until they were kicked out for stealing stuff to fund their addiction, and then became homeless, they might just use the financial leeway that PSH affords on continuing their habit. The State of Homelessness in America, reporting on the work of Kurtz and Johnson, says, for outcomes such as impacts on substance abuse and mental illness, Housing First in general performs no better than any other approaches. Michael Schellenberger points out that progressives misunderstand and misdescribe drug addiction as just poor people. They look poor, and they are poor, but that's a consequence of suffering the mental illness that we call addiction, not simply having been poor. And to some extent, it's San Francisco's great wealth that's created the crisis on the streets, by which I mean San Francisco gives out cash, gives out free housing, it gives out many other amenities to people who demand them, often in support of their addiction, and that's attracted people to San Francisco. It's created these open drug scenes, whereas in other cities that haven't been so generous, we haven't seen open drug scenes and open air dealing. So in conclusion, all of this ties into the utopia first type thinking I described in my first article. People aren't thinking whether socialism actually works, they think it's more fair, so it is the most moral. Similarly, the thinking here seems to be that it's not fair that there are all these homes that the rich people have that they aren't using, while there are all these people struggling with housing, so it's most moral to just steal those houses and give them to the people who need them the most. Like most of these utopia first types of plans that gain support because they sound great, they quickly crumble when you get into the specifics or when you simply ask, what happens after that? Second Thoughts videos seem to follow a three-step resentment-stoking pattern. First, describing things about the average person's life that they might not be happy with. Second, point out that the capitalists' lives are much better. Third, say in so many words, therefore, socialism is the solution. So after the resentment towards the better off is sufficiently stoked, then he is poised to offer up a very vague, simplistic solution, like just give the people who need a house a vacant house. That sounds so great and fair that it might not leave people worrying about the specifics. If the fact that socialism has utterly failed time and time again wasn't reason enough, We should avoid at all costs ideas like Marxism or socialism that breed resentment in people. Second Thought pushes heavily this idea that you are either in the exploited or the exploiter class. The idea is the reason your life isn't how you want it to be is because someone else got their life how they wanted it to be. Second Thought thinks this has to be the case because, as we discussed last time, he incorrectly sees the employer-employee relationship as a zero-sum game. For someone to win, someone else has to lose. The thinking is that the rich get rich because they take from the poor. But the reality is that if you look at the data, upper class and middle and low class incomes have risen since 1970.